From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Lib Dems have criticised Labour and the Tories for what they describe as both parties' spending fantasies. Sir Ed Davey has been pledging £100 million to tackle climate change if they win the general election. He's ruling out forming a coalition with either Jeremy Corbyn or Boris Johnson.
We're not going to vote for them to be the Prime Minister. But if either of them form a minority government, as is possible, we will vote issue by issue. We will vote where we agree with the government, and where we disagree, we'll vote against.
Labour's offering free broadband for all, while the Tories want to help struggling towns. The former American ambassador to Ukraine has given evidence against the president at his impeachment inquiry. Marie Yovanovitch told a committee her removal played into the hands of corrupt politicians all over the world. But Republican Devin Nunes says the entire inquiry is a distraction.
Democrats have been vowing to oust President Trump since the day he was elected. So Americans can rightly suspect that his phone call with President Zelensky was used as an excuse for the Democrats to fulfill their Watergate fantasies.
An ally of Donald Trump has been found guilty of 7 charges, including lying to politicians, and now faces up to 20 years in jail. Prosecutors say Roger Stone's lies related to WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange. A man from Doncaster has been sentenced to a year in jail after sending a threatening message to Anna Soubry. Alden Bryce Barlow's fingerprints were found on the letter. Nissan is recalling over 450,000 vehicles worldwide because of fire safety concerns. It's the firm's third recall for a problem relating to a brake fluid leak, but most models affected are said to be in North America. And Rafael Nadal has confirmed his place as end-of-year world number one. The Spaniard came back from a set-down to win against Stefanos Tsitsipas. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.
That's enough of the incriminating talk. We're on the air. This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is the Brexit Party candidate for North Somerset, Anne Tarr. Hoping also to have in the studio retired teacher and South West NUT rep Nina Franklin. So, of course, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, it's Israel on the offensive in Syria and Gaza, despite not having a properly constituted government. Is it simply a case of the military like a weak government, because then they can do exactly what they like? And a coup in Bolivia plays out rather differently to the way last year's election did in Venezuela. Indigenous rights president Evo Morales has to flee the country. But who's now in charge, and was this coup arranged by the United States? If so, why are they working with fascists within Bolivia? Plus, in our World War II series, The Battle of Arnhem, questions answered by the founding Deputy Director General of the United Nations in the 40s and the intelligence officer who was sacked. He'd warned it was going to be a disaster, and he was sacked just 2 days before Operation Market Garden, the Bridge Too Far battle, went so terribly wrong. Sacked because he was right. Plus Bormann in the bunker, the end of the war and the writing of Hitler's will. And with it, a bank account containing at least $1 billion. All takes off in Bormann's pocket from the Fuhrer bunker. On the 1st of May 1945. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So tonight, lows around 5 Celsius, some light rain. This weekend, highs around 9 Celsius, light cloud tomorrow, but thicker on Sunday. So maybe a little bit of bit of sunshine Saturday. Doesn't look likely on Sunday, though. Next week, highs around 10 Celsius, average, a mainly cloudy week with some sunny spells and patchy rain. Next weekend, that's the 23rd and 24th of November, highs around 10 Celsius, some sunshine and fleeting showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is the Brexit Party candidate for North Somerset, Anne Tarr. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. I am not a candidate in this election, obviously, because we're all stood down, well, all of us standing in Conservative seats.
Well, that's very honest of you to pit me to the post there, but this has been a big, big week for you, hasn't it? So what is it? Was it like having campaigned since the beginning of the party, which is only really a few months old, and then suddenly being told, no, you're not allowed to stand?
Well, we always knew this was a possibility, and I think Nigel always made it clear that we would put country before party, and we all agreed to that, and that is what's happened. So we were asked to put the good of the country and the good for Brexit before our own personal ambitions and so on, and so that's what we've done.
So will you be voting for Liam Fox?
Fortunately, it's a secret ballot, so you will never know.
But, I mean, surely you haven't got a choice, have you?
Well, I have a choice between a Lib Dem and a Labour, and I think a Green, or Dr Fox, as you rightly say. And I'm not sure I'm going to be voting for any of those, to be perfectly honest with you.
320 or so Brexit Party candidates being told to stand down. Does sound as if Boris is a very good deal-breaker, because you didn't get really anything at all from the Brexit Party in return, did you?
Well, I'm not sure that's the case. I think if you look at what the Brexit Party's done since its launch, which, as you said, was only, what, 8-9 months ago, we've already changed politics for good in this country. We got rid of Theresa May, possibly the worst Prime Minister ever. We got Boris to reopen this new treaty the EU wanted us to sign, and he has made further concessions over the past weekend. So now we just need to make sure he does actually follow through on those.
Will he? I mean, do you have faith in Boris? I mean, he's a known liar after all, isn't he?
Yeah, that's a very difficult one to answer. And if I'm totally honest, I would say no, I don't trust Boris. But then again, he's now on record and we will hold his feet to the fire.
But he's going to be in, if he does get in, for another 5 years. It's going to be, you know, a long time before anything actually be done about all this.
Yeah, well, that depends on whether we have a majority or a hung parliament or quite what happens. So we just have to see. If we have if we end up with a big majority for the Conservatives, yes, we'll have to see what happens in that situation.
Martin, I see you smiling over there to see the pain of the Brexit Party, a lot of people not being allowed to stand. And actually, really, it's back to the good old Bullingdon Club, Boris, Eton, taking over.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, I would say rather the opposite. We were rather looking forward to a split Brexit vote. So it's going to make our task slightly harder. It's not necessarily the end of the world. I mean, I think Anne would agree with me. The electoral system is a nonsense, and it leaves us all to a situation where none of us can get and vote for what we really want, because we're constantly being second guessed by the way the system's set up to basically keep the old guard in power.
Any reply to that, Anne?
Yeah, well, I think Martin's absolutely right there. It's one of the few times where the Lib Dems and myself actually agree on things, which is that we need to reform the political system in this country. And I'm fed up of candidates coming out of the right university, going into special advisor jobs, getting parachuted into seats, and then they end up in a nice comfortable seat with a big majority. And what accountability do they have?
So do any of the Brexit Party candidates or members... Oh, hang on, they don't really have a membership, do they? It's not really a democratic system. It's really just like, actually a bit like a kind of fiefdom, isn't it? Where someone at the top, should we call him the Sheriff of Nottingham or maybe a king, decides we are going to do this, and all the Brexit Party candidates just simply have to do as they're told. There isn't really, I mean, you don't have the democratic sort of system like the Labour Party, for example, do in their conference, where decisions can be made gently there, bringing everybody on board. You just simply have to do as you're told, don't you?
I think if you try and compare a party that's been going for over 100 years and the Brexit Party, which has been going for only 9 months, there's a bit of a difference. And I think you also have to look at the issues which UKIP had when it started to attract attract maybe some less desirable people into it. And so if you look at the modern structures of anything, if you look at Uber, it's one of the major taxi firms, doesn't have any taxis. You look at Airbnb, major supplier of hotel rooms, doesn't actually own any hotel rooms. So I think what you're looking at is a different system of doing it with the aim of actually trying to achieve what it wants. So and the system will develop over time.
So the Brexit Party is a political party, but it doesn't have any democracy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I wouldn't. No, that's not true. It's not true to say it doesn't have democracy. It does have democracy, and there is decision making going on in there. It just hasn't been fully developed as yet.
You can have all you candidates can put your hands up, but I'm afraid it doesn't matter because the one person at the front is saying no.
Well, I don't think that's different to many other parties, to be perfectly honest. If you look at some of the issues that come out this week from candidates, I think it was the Leicester Labour candidate who was absolutely incandescent that a candidate had been parachuted in from London into a seat which he thought he was going to win. So it's not, I think all parties have to face this issue. And really the key thing is how do we make sure that people in local constituency have some say over who's actually representing them, regardless of your political affiliation. So as a North Somerset constituent, what say do I have over the candidate who is elected or who is selected to represent the Conservative Party?
Martin, the Brexit Party have followed suit with the Remain Alliance, really, in saying, well, we need an electoral pact in order to get round this first-past-the-post medieval-style voting system. So why hasn't the Labour Party wised up to this?
Well, the Labour Party, is because of the as Anne just said, it's got 100 years of history, and you can't, and a rule book, which is, a massively complex rule book, and it's very difficult. I mean, you look at all the internal infighting we've had over the last few years about the direction of policy, and that's a very big disadvantage in one way. You can't just have one single message in the same way as something like the Brexit Party, as Anne said. Farage has kind of copied what Beppe Grillo and the Five Star Movement did in Italy, where they basically replaced the mainstream left with a new structure. But,
well, that might mean that the Labour Party is going to get replaced.
Well, it could be. I mean, that could easily happen in this kind of world we live in.
So but anyway, why is Jeremy Corbyn not doing these electoral pacts? He needs to do that to get round the system, sure.
Well, I said when he first stood as leader of the Labour Party and he came to Bristol, I was at a meeting where he was, getting quite a lot of support. And I put the first question to him, said in New Zealand in the early 1980s, the Labour Party committed to proportional representation, even when it was in power, because the Labour grassroots were fed up with the Labour right wing doing the wrong things. And because it's a small country, they knocked on every door in the country within 6 months. They had a referendum and they forced it through, which led to a very radical Labour government. And Jacinda Ardern, who's the current Labour leader in New Zealand, she rules with the support of New Zealand First, which are similar to the Brexit Party in some respects, although it's got a more Maori tinge than in this country. And that's because they just got ahead and did it years ago. I've always recommended the Labour Party to do that, but it's like turning around a super tanker. They're used to doing things that one way, and it's very hard to persuade people to do it a different way.
It might take a very bad election defeat in order for them to actually start to do things.
Well, or a hung parliament where they've got to do deals with other people who believe in PR.
We've just had one of those, so they haven't.
Well, there might be another one.
They haven't learned that lesson, have they? So anyway, let's have a listen now to Nigel Farage on Monday, because it was quite a surprising announcement, but it does definitely follow on the heels of the Green Party, Plaid Cymru, SNP. And who's the other ones? Oh, yeah, the Lib Dems pact.
The Brexit Party will not contest the 317 seats the Conservatives won at the last election. But what we will do is concentrate our total effort into all of the seats that are held by the Labour Party, who have completely broken their manifesto pledge in 2017 to respect the result of the referendum. And we will also take on the rest of the Remainer parties. We will stand up and we will fight them all. Like it, it's not easy. It's not easy. But how do we hold Boris to his promises? That's the key to this, isn't it? That's the key to whether this strategy actually works. We will expose the fact of Labour's complete betrayal of 5 million of their own voters. And the way that we keep Boris Johnson to his promises is we have to start to win some of these seats. That's what we need to do in this election. Because when we do that, and we have a Brexit Party voice in Parliament, we're going to keep saying, remember, you told us we were leaving by the end of 2020. Remember, you told us we're not going to have political alignment. And actually, he'll know. Just as Mrs. May's vote disappeared in the European elections of this year, the same will happen again if a British Prime Minister breaks firm commitments and promises that are made to the British people.
Well, from a sort of objective political science kind of point of view, it makes sense for the Brexit Party under a first-past-the-post setup to try to make some attempt to create a coalition of the forces that they're trying to represent. But I think the fact of the matter is that the country is split, and what will happen after the election is everybody will look at the votes, and whichever side has got 50% plus one, even if they've won, they won't necessarily be accepted as a mandate. And of course, that's what's happened in the United States, where Donald Trump got 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton, but still became the president because the system allows that. But ultimately, of course, when you're facing off with a democratic Russia, where their people are elected by 60% plus, you start the question that the whole thing is creaking at the seams. So it could easily happen one way, that we get a Remainer majority, but a hard Brexit, or we could get a Remainer government, but a Brexit majority in the country. Either of those things are possible under our rubbish system.
Yeah, I you're quite right that the system doesn't actually deliver democracy to the people in the sense that every vote counts in this country. And what we need to decide on is how we actually move forward from this. But what's important for us from a Brexit Party perspective is, as Nigel just said, is to get some candidates elected. We need some MPs in Parliament so we can start doing this. And that's our number one priority.
But surely, I mean, if you've got 320 less standing, you've got 320 less chance of getting elected.
Well, I think the real people who feel let down at the moment are the Labour Leave vote. So if you look at some of the Northern Labour seats, the messages we're getting from there is support for the Brexit Party is extremely high. And those are the seats we need to win. That's why we have Richard Tice standing up in Hartlepool, but also down in the south in Plymouth, we have Anne Widdecombe.
Well, one of the Labour Party members, Sheena Moore, made a film a little while ago, about a year or so ago, about all this. And there are quite, you're quite right, there are quite a lot of people, Martin, from the Labour Party up north, who just don't feel betrayed by... I mean, these are basically people who've seen industry collapse under the EU, and particularly mining communities, that sort of thing. They actually just want to get out of the EU. They voted for it, and many of these Labour MPs are Remain MPs, and yet their voter base is very pro-leave. Let's have a listen to Sheena Moore, who's a Labour person from up... I think it's Doncaster area.
Do you think after 30 years of him campaigning against the EU, that as a leader of the Labour Party, he's actually took the progressive right-wing Labour Party line to appease them? Because I do.
I do.
And I think it's backfired dramatically, because I think he had the working class vote. I mean, to see UKIP getting votes, to me, is absolutely appalling, astonished. And they did get votes in these areas, and I think they're the traditional Labour voters who had no one to vote for, because they couldn't vote for a Tory Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn was pulling that vote back.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, because in actual fact, as you know, 19 Labour MPs voted for Boris Johnson's deal. And that was because he lost the 10 DUP voters. So in actual fact, the Labour Party is split. It's quite clear the majority of MPs and Labour activists are pro-Remain. Don't think there's much of a secret about that. But there's a substantial chunk of people are pro-Leave.
What about these people that just don't feel they've got anyone to vote for anymore? But because of Corbyn has decided, no, he's not going to honour the result of the referendum, but he's going to actually call for a second referendum.
Corbyn comes under attack from the pro-Remain wing of the party because he's not taken what they regard as a pro-Remain enough stance, and he's actually on a hide into nothing, which whatever he does. I think basically, I broadly agree. I think, but what I would say to Leave voters in those constituencies, if you vote Labour and we win, there will be a definite referendum on leaving the EU, and you can vote to leave the EU.
I think the real issue here is there's a whole swathe of people who don't feel that any political party represents them. And the old message of I'm on the left, I'm on the right, I'm Labour, I'm Tory no longer holds valid. What really happens is, are you able to participate in the growing wealth of this country, or are you one of the people who feel that you've been left behind because you haven't got the basic things that you need in order to live? And you see very clearly in Bristol, where Bristol is a city of two halves, where some parts are very affluent and some parts are great poverty, and that's replicated across the whole country. And who is speaking for those people who do feel they've been left behind? It's not the Islington Labour Party, as is often seen now, or the Westminster bubble, which includes all the Tory toffs such as Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Oh, so, I mean, the Brexit Party has actually made it more difficult for people to find someone to vote for, some people would argue. And one of those people who would argue that, who we had on this programme a few weeks ago, is the Brexit Party candidate for Gloucester, Richard Ford. And here he is speaking on Radio Gloucester earlier this week. I think it was actually on Monday, the day he heard that, after all his efforts, no, he wasn't going to be allowed to be a candidate for the Brexit Party.
We've been out most Saturdays outside the Guildhall in Gloucester. We've been leafleting with lots of enthusiasm, lots of supporters. And I think that's the point. The problem is there are so many, many people that came up to us in Gloucester, or come up to us regularly in Gloucester, and say, thank you so much for standing. You're the only Leave candidate in a Leave voting city. And that's the problem. I think those people will be very, very upset because they'll have nobody to vote for. They'll stay at home. I mean, Gloucester has voted three times now for Leave, in the referendum, in the general election in 2017, when Richard Graham increased his majority by falsely promising to implement the result of the referendum a year earlier. And Labour, of course, also stood on that ticket. So 85% of the people voted for Labour Conservative in that general election across the country, because they believed that the referendum would be honoured. And, of course, earlier this year, the Brexit Party got 38.5% in Gloucester City. So three times Gloucester has voted to leave, and now it seems we've got a choice. There will be six candidates in Gloucester, as far as I know, in the parliamentary election. Labour, Lib Dem, Conservative, Green and Renew Party, all of whom are Remainers of one degree or another, from the Liberal Democrats who want to revoke Article 50 to Richard Graham, who is a long-standing Remainer, Conservative candidate who basically wants to flog Theresa May's heated-up Brino deal. Richard Graham voted to extend Article 50. He voted to take the so-called no deal off the table. So it's five others.
Well, he's voted for Brexit each time because he's gone with the Prime Minister in each case, whether it's Theresa May or Boris Johnson.
That isn't the Brexit that people voted for, of course. You know, there are lots of strings attached to that. And Richard Graham is a Remainer. He was here with Theresa May in Gloucester.
Well, it's good enough for Nigel Farage, because your leader, he said that is the only way we're going to stop another referendum, which is possible.
I doubt very much that Nigel Farage has ever heard of Richard Graham here in Gloucestershire. We have a situation now where Gloucester, a Leave voting city, doesn't have a Leave voting candidate, and Stroud, held by Labour at the moment, a Remain voting district, does have a candidate for that. So I think the broad brushstroke clearly hasn't worked.
Well, so there's Richard Ford trying to untangle what was happening with the Brexit Party. But his case, I mean, just to say, I mean, the Conservatives obviously would argue that their candidate is a Leave candidate, and very much is a Leave candidate. But, I mean, what do you make of the sort of reduction in choice that your party has now done with this deal with the Tories? Well, actually, it's not a deal with the Tories. They've just caved in without trying to even make a deal.
We've made a unilateral decision with... So that is where we are. The one thing that makes me really quite cross, even angry, is this business that somehow it's all the fault of the Brexit Party. If the two main parties had done what they said they were going to do in their manifestos in 2017, there'd be no need for Nigel Farage to come out of what was really much a retirement. There'd be no reason for us to even be in existence. So please don't put the blame at the Brexit Party, because we're the ones trying to solve a problem here, which is, how do you stand up and give a voice for the 17.4 million people who voted to leave, and more importantly, the 3 million people who I believe voted for the first time in that referendum, who normally don't vote because they feel disenfranchised.
We're also joined today by Nina Franklin, who's a retired teacher, I believe, aren't you, Nina?
Yes, yeah.
And from, were you also in... to trawl through my ancient, get the cobwebs out of my memory cells. Remember, you, I think at one time, were a national executive member for Bristol or the southwest of England or something, wasn't
I right? was, and I was also the national president of the NUT for a year.
Wow, fantastic. Anyway, so it's so lovely of you to come in, because we were discussing last Friday the merchant venturers and their interest in education in the city. And I thought maybe we'd start, before we hear from you, to hear from Christine Townsend, who's a campaigner we have on this programme from time to time, on education, to look at what she has to say, really, about the merchants. And because it's not just the merchant venturists that are controlling these schools now in Bristol, the academised semi-privatised schools that are run by supposedly charitable trusts at arm's length from the merchant ventures, but there are all sorts of problems here because the merchant ventures themselves have got virtually no scrutiny whatsoever. Being constituted under a royal charter means their accounts are completely opaque. No one knows how much money they've got or what they do with it. And that means, of course, that there could be other deals going on behind the scenes, which certainly the staff have got absolutely no idea what's going on there. So let's hear now from Christine, who will say something just about some of the ownership of the schools now in the city.
Well, the thing is that Bristol University is also involved in running schools in the city, and that they have recently made an announcement around looking into their own archives and their own history as institutions. Now, I think that's a really good response, a fantastic response. And if the merchant venturers or if the church, who are also, you know, the cathedral, were in, you know, if they were to open up and be more transparent, I think they would learn a lot, and they would then also understand maybe why it is that people say, well, what are you doing in the church? What is the bishop saying to hundreds of children?
Well, the reason we're talking about this is because there was the annual charter day of Bristol's merchant venturers, who've been going for hundreds and hundreds of years, set up in medieval times, and now running our schools, Nina. And why shouldn't they? Surely that's perfectly reasonable in this modern academy world.
Well, all schools should be run democratically by a local authority, of which the members are elected by the people in the area. The academies project has in effect privatised our schools and given them the opportunity to become private schools. They now run directly from Westminster and by the DfE.
Well, in which case they're not privatised, are they, if they're being run from Westminster?
Well, they're not being run with much scrutiny in the way that local authority schools would be run, for instance. They get very large sums of money. And it's very attractive because if you remember, a few years back, two of the existing private schools actually bid for money from the government and became state schools. There were very attractive amounts of money to be made. I think we have to also be aware that this is part of a much more global education movement. It's known as the Global Education Reform Movement, which had started with the charter schools in America, and basically the charter school is the same as what we now have, free schools. A local authority cannot open a school at the moment. It has to be a free school.
So what have we missed, or what have we lost now that local authorities aren't really involved in schools? Surely it's that the schools, the people who are running them, are just a little bit freer to do what they want.
Well, it's some of the things that they're free enough to do. I mean, you know, as a trade unionist for many years, we fought for, a comprehensive education system where no child was disadvantaged. We also fought for good terms and conditions for all our members, national pay scales, good conditions. I mean, the first thing that very often goes out of the window are all those really important areas. I mean, these schools are free to set their own admission policies. Some of them have become virtually selective. And there are, as Christine will tell you, there are children in certain parts of Bristol that have got absolutely no chance of getting into some of these schools. Some of them are even reserving places for children outside of Bristol.
So is that, I mean, because of where they live? Why can't those kids get into those schools?
It's due to the very restrictive selection policies some of the schools have actually opposed. I mean, we've got schools that only take from a certain postcode. And in the past, the local authority had a much more equal and fair admissions policy, and local authority schools followed that. I mean, basically, these schools can more or less select who they want. And because of the sort of reliance on, you know, being high achieving schools in terms of Ofsted and all that sort of thing, it also means that they can exclude huge proportions of children that, you know, really need to be in school.
Well, it's probably fair to say the biggest merchant venturer school in the city is Merchants Academy in Withywood. They are under special measures by Ofsted. They're also classed as inadequate, and yet, nevertheless, they've managed to raise the money to build two new schools. Does it not matter if you're inadequate or you're in special measures? You can just go and build as many as you want?
Well, it's very strange the way the merchants can do that, because of the fact that the normal situation is if a school goes, if we think of a local authority school, if it goes into a category that is underperforming, so in need of support or special measures.
Well, they're getting visits very regularly, aren't they, from Ofsted, just to see how they're getting
on. Yeah, but normally that school would then be taken over by a high-performing. It basically gets closed and reopens as a sort of new school. However, you know, that's just not something that has happened to the merchants. And you can't really... A lot of the people involved in the Cathedral School Trust are also merchant venturers.
Oh, right. So this is another one of the Cathedral School Trust. You've got the merchant venturers, and also... Christine was talking about the church as well. So these are some of the institutions now running the city.
Yeah.
Well, the great and the good, they call them, don't they?
Yes, yeah. And it's seen as a sort of philanthropic move. I mean, I was actually involved in, I think it's 2008 when the Merchants Academy was set up. And, you know, got taken up to their big place up by the Downs, you know, and told that, you know, it was purely a charitable. They'd always been involved.
So did they
what,
did they wine and dine you?
Well, I wouldn't say, we had a buffet lunch.
Any champagne?
No.
Oh. Well, it's, I have to put in some complaints about that. I mean, they can certainly afford it. Anyway, so what about teacher morale at Merchants Academy particularly? Because this is their flagship school. It's not looking good on paper. The documents say inadequate. They say special measures, and yet they're expanding. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe they're expanding those inadequacy, you know, at the moment. Although, to be fair, Ofsted have been saying more recently that they're getting better and they're on the road to recovery. But what's teacher morale like there, and what sort of issues are teachers
I'm got? Not currently a union officer, and I would say it was a little bit sensitive because there are... I know that the union is involved with our with members at Merchants.
So is there recognition for the union there?
At the moment, I think the recognition... is gone.
Oh.
When we set it up in 2008...
You know what this reminds me of? The National Union of Journalists. We had recognition at the Bristol Post, and yet it didn't really kind of transpire to mean anything. They got their lawyers onto it and said, well, we found a little kind of chink in the armour here and we can't have these meetings. Oh, dear, oh, dear. And of course, you know, the Bristol Post, of course, has got links to the merchants too.
We certainly had it when it was first set up. We went to lots of meetings. It was quite positive. So, you know, I would argue we do have union recognition, but it just seems that over the years they have their own contracts as well that they can put, I mean, all sorts of conditions in, such as teachers have to remain on the site until 5:30 at night. They also had a rifle range in those days. And an army cadet force, which I think they still have.
Well, some schools have that, don't they?
Yeah.
They have army cadets and air cadets, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Sea cadets. Mm. I mean, that was a normal thing in the old days.
Well, it was, but at the same time, I think for teachers to be expected, some teachers do not want to have any involvement with that sort of thing. And, you know, to then be told... as has happened in the past, that, you know, their salaries depended on their involvement with those sort of projects. It's very difficult. And I think, we can't get the actual turnover figures for staff, but I think it's been very high in the past.
Yes, that was one of the things that was happening a lot at the Post as well. Yeah. There was a lot of high turnover of staff at these organisations. And that does indicate morale, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
I mean, morale, of course, is the thing that gets you up in the morning and gets you into work as a public servant.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I think lowers morale for classroom teachers is, look at the salary structure. I mean, there used to be a national pay scale, and the most a head teacher could earn, and this would be in a large comprehensive, perhaps in the middle of London, would be, you know, just over 100,000. Then it was based on the size of the school and the type of problems it has. Virtually all the sort of CEOs of these big academy trusts are all on over 200,000 a year. There's very few.
Can you have a chief executive of a charity? It doesn't sound quite right somehow. You say, I mean, maybe chief executive of Shell, but if you're a charitable trust.
Yes, yeah.
But they do, don't they?
Yeah. And also.
And what sort of salaries are they on?
Well, of course, they don't publish them.
Oh, really?
Okay. And you can sometimes get them from Freedom of Information request, but I don't think that's ever successfully been got from many of them. I think the other thing to remember is that when you're a charity, you don't pay business rates on your buildings, whereas if you're a local primary school, you pay business rates. You know, and the merchants being a sort of big charity, and they've got huge amounts of money in investments and stuff over the years.
How do you know? I mean, I always, of course they have, but they don't want anyone to know how much money they've got.
No.
I mean, they're basically like the Bristol Illuminati, aren't they? Martin, this whole system for running schools, it does seem as if, I mean, for example, what we've seen in some places is that the school sees its land that it now controls as a way to sort of make commercial capital out of it. So it will close some school buildings and hire them out to local businesses, that sort of thing. So the character of the school is definitely changing.
Absolutely. I mean, basically, the whole idea of competition between schools, which is so normal in the private sector. My father used to be a head teacher in the state sector, and of course he was very opposed to all of these changes when they were brought in the 1980s, because basically what should happen in schools in an area like Bristol is they should cooperate and share resources to provide the widest possible choices for the kids that you're trying to teach. So for example, if you've got a playing field, you share it with other schools, and that was normal practice. But of course the whole idea of marketising education, which came in the 1980s, is schools are firms which are in competition with each other. Now that, in fact, is perfectly normal in the private sector, but it's absolutely poison in the state sector. And eventually, of course, my dad argued at the time. He said, look, if you're going to have each school as a separate cost base, you've got to give them a certain amount of money, and you can go to the popular school, which will have 35 in the class, or you can go to the unpopular school with 15 in the class, and you'll soon find that it would even out. But in any case, what you ought to do is have planning to make sure you've got enough school places for the population that you're trying to service. And of course, what's happened now with the Colston Girls' School, for example, used to be private. They then, after the crash, the parents found that things were a bit tight, so they then joined the state system, and now those parents don't have to pay the fees, the government pays the fees, but of course they've still inherited the demographic structure from the previous previous kids. So if you're a girl living in St Paul's, where it's based, you've got hardly any chance of getting in there, but they're bringing kids in from Gloucestershire on the train, paid for by the government now.
Anyway, we're talking about this because of Charter Day on Monday, where hundreds of children from the Merchants Trust schools, Merchants Academy and elsewhere, were bussed in to celebrate something. Well, one does wonder, Anne, if what they're celebrating is the fact that their accounts are kept secret, that no one's allowed to know what money they're coming from, how much money they've got or where it's going.
Point of order, Tony.
Yes?
The Charter Day is not for the Merchant Ventures, it's for Colston School. Yeah. So, in other words, they set up Colston Girls and Boys School years ago, and the Colston Boys School remains private sector.
Well, as I understand, it's Merchant Venturers Charter Day, and that's when they got their charter. But anyway, Anne, what do you make of this privatisation of education? We've got someone here who's had a lot of experience in education. She's saying, actually, it's all going in the wrong direction.
Well, I'm Chair of Governors for Primary School, and having looked at education and looking at what's happening in our secondary schools as well, I have to question whether or not we've actually got everything set up as we should and quite what the point of education is today. And that is to say, what are we actually trying to achieve with our schools? What are we trying to achieve with the education? And why are we pushing so many students into university? And I think this is a broader discussion that we need rather than just looking at the structure of the schools. I'm not a particular...
What we're talking about really is not necessarily the structure, it's about the ownership of the school.
Yeah.
Who is actually running them? As a chair of governors, what sort of school is yours? Or is it a local authority school, or is it an academy school?
No, it's a local authority school. It's voluntary aided. So I'm uncomfortable with some of the academisation for the reasons that have been said, and for the fact that you have a chief executive running the school, and quite what the local control is over that school, because at the moment you do have accountability, and where do you get that accountability once you become an academy? And I think there is this sort of secret privatisation that's been going on with some of the academies. I mean, we've seen it with some of the Oasis schools in Bristol as well. And where is all this going to end, and who is actually providing some of the money? Because we know there isn't a lot of money in education, so who is putting this money in, and why are they doing it?
One of the things that bothers me more than anything else about this, Nina, is the things like gagging clauses in because I mean, it means that, I mean, it's like something in the health service, for example. We obviously need whistleblowers to be able to blow the whistle when they see something going wrong, and the same exact thing is true for schools, isn't it, really?
There is going to be quite a serious teacher shortage, because so many teachers, not just in academies but in lots of schools, just had enough of the workload, the long hours and everything else. And we have been, we call them settlement agreements, but they do contain a confidentiality clause. And there are very few, lots of times we've suggested that they do exit interviews. But because of the confidentiality.
So what's that?
Well, it would be that the person is interviewed possibly by a governor to find out why they're leaving.
That would make sense, wouldn't it? Especially if there's a hemorrhaging of staff and a high turnover. Martin, what can we do? You know, what is the Labour Party going to do? Anything?
Well, I think, I don't know what policy is at the moment, the full detail.
Too busy with the broadband, maybe.
Well, there's all sorts of things that need to be discussed. I think the basic principle has to be that we've got to go back to having a planned system. I know people hate the word plan, but that's what we're supposed to do in lessons, and that's what we're supposed to do in life. And the idea that we just let... You see, one of the things about having competition between schools is, in the private sector, things are allowed to go bust. Now, if your kids are in a school that's going bust, that's part of it. You know, at least a tenth of the schools must go bust if it's going to work. But if your kids are in those schools, and they don't get a second chance at an education. And that's why the whole purpose of having a comprehensive system, which we brought in my era, was, you know, getting rid of the grammar schools and all the rest.
Well, my bugbear is getting rid of the grammar schools, because Martin, you've had your say there. My bugbear is getting rid of the grammar schools, because the grammar schools managed to do what the public schools used to do, and that is to find intelligent, poor kids and give them an absolutely top-notch education.
Only 20% of the kids.
Anyway, I mean, this is for the academic ones. But anyway, Nina, the final word goes to you. What would you like to see any future government do? Let's hope it's not Boris, from your point of view, but what should they be doing?
Well, I would like SATs test to be abolished, and I'd like Ofsted to be abolished in favour of peer evaluation.
Actually, I think the Labour Party are saying they're going to abolish SATs, aren't they?
They are saying that, yeah. Smaller class sizes. I mean, you wouldn't need grammar schools if you had small class sizes and enough funding to make sure every child could get everything that they deserve out of education. There is a plan that schools will be brought back under some sort of local authority structure. I don't think I know exactly how that's going to work, but I suspect that funding will have a big influence on that. So smaller class sizes, also much more freedom for teachers to teach. I started teaching in 1973, and I loved teaching. It was the best job in the world. But what I loved was the fact that you could be creative, and that you could develop the kids to be creative and learn, what was good for them. You really are stuck now, because you've got to get them through test, you've got to get them through GCSE, and they change the goalposts all the time. So we need to bring back a lot more of that creativity.
Sounds like teaching has gone from an art to a science, and it lost something along the way, maybe. Mm. But anyway, Nina, frankly, thanks ever so much for coming. It's been a pleasure to have you here. And maybe before you go, you could just give us your prediction for the general election. Any thoughts?
Well, I think it'll be a a Labour government, and I really hope it, and I'm doing everything I can.
Well done, okay. But I'm just looking at the poll here. Britain elects the most recent one, which is from yesterday, on Twitter. I suggest you follow that, quite good. The latest poll is Conservatives at 40%, up 3%, Labour at 30%, up 1%, Lib Dems at 16%, minus 1%, Brexit Party down 2%, at 7%, and the Green Party on 3%. But the although they're at the bottom, the Green Party did launched their general election campaign this week. So I think we ought to have a listen to what they had to say there.
Boris Johnson wants to make this the Brexit election, a rerun of the referendum, a fight on his terms, on his dodgy turf. But this election is about so much more. Yes, Greens are the strongest voice for remaining in the European Union because we must protect environmental standards and work with our neighbours to avoid climate chaos. Because we must protect our precious freedom of movement, our human rights and our peace. Because we must remain and transform. But some things are even bigger than Brexit. This must be the climate election. The future won't get another chance. That is why Greens, like you, will be coming to cities all over the UK, knocking on doors, getting out on the streets, fighting for every single vote we can to make sure that this election goes down in history as the turning point in our fight for climate justice. Let's be honest about the situation we're in. We know these are dark times. It's easy to fear the future. The threat of Brexit hangs over our heads. The climate emergency rages from the Amazon to the Arctic, and our fragile democracy is under attack. But despite all this, Greens don't fear the future. We are the future. We stand at the threshold of what could be the most exciting and prosperous period of our country's history, because taking action on the climate emergency isn't just about averting disaster, it's about creating a brand new Britain.
And that's not my editing, that's their editing, with the claps seeming to come a bit peculiar moments. Martin, for a start, the Greens are going to be pinching a lot of your votes, certainly in this city, aren't they, from the Labour Party?
Well, I think in Bristol West, where we are here, there's going to be a Labour-Green contest, effectively.
Do you think they're right to go on climate? Obviously, there's a lot of action.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that
A lot of action on the streets on that one, isn't there? This is people are turning out, actually coming out onto the streets over that issue. Why is the, you know, they're obviously trumped Labour on climate, surely?
Well, I mean, Thangam, who's the local MP for the Labour Party, would probably disagree, because she's basically got fairly green ideas herself. So it's a bit of a luxury fight around here, because the Conservatives will probably come third, and it'll be a fight between the Labour Party and the Greens, and they'll have to work. But it's only in this particular constituency. It's rather special. It's particularly, you know, that's the demography around here.
I mean, basically, the Labour Party is hoping that this election is not going to be about Brexit, but it's a pretty forlorn hope, that, isn't it?
Well, I think there's no way that it's not going to be partly about Brexit. I think what happened last time is that Theresa May called an election thinking it was just going to be about Brexit, and it turned out to be about an awful lot more other things as well. 10 years of austerity.
But all the main parties were saying, yeah, we're going to deliver the referendum.
Well, hang on, I'll be as brief as I can on this. There are various versions of Brexit, and that's what we're arguing about. I could live with a Norway deal. No problem at all, but I'm not having a no-deal Brexit.
Well, Norway deal?
Norway voted twice to stay out of the EU, but they're in the single market.
We know what the Norway deal does. What it does is you have to do what the European Court of Justice says you've got to do, all that, but you don't get any say.
Well, that's right.
So why would people want that?
Well, in Norway, they've voted on that twice, and they've decided just for the hell of it, they'd like to be independent, but they're going to be in the single market anyway. And we, of course, a bigger country, we're probably better off inside. That's why we need a referendum. Another one.
Anyway, what do you make of the Green Party's pitch there, Anne?
Well, I'm bit concerned about green policies, and I think what's interesting, if you look in some countries, I think at the last election in Australia, the Green Party was expected to do very well. It was expected to be all about green issues, and the reality was very different. So are people really green, or do they just pretend to be green for the pollsters?
We're going to find that out in Bristol with the diesel ban. Before we hear from you two on this, because this is going to definitely be coming up over the next months and couple of years, I guess. I think it's 2021 it's due to be implemented. And this is the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees speaking the other week on Five Live about the diesel ban and the rationale behind it in the city.
I'm not going to sit here and spill out the specifics because that's got to go out for consultation. But what I can say is we have a list of the risks that we think are live. We've always had this through the Clean Air Zone and the diesel ban. And what we will do is begin working with the city and our partners to minimise those risks and make sure Bristol people are adversely affected.
We saw earlier Sally Challoner's efforts to get to work on the bus. People will be saying, look, Mr Mayor, put in the public transport as it is in London and some...
Sorry, this is not Five Live, obviously. This is Points West here. David Garnston.
But you can't do it this way round.
Well,
you can't ban cars and not have the public transport up and running.
Well, that's not an option because we've got a deadline we need to meet. And if we don't meet it, as you've reported on numerous occasions, we're on the end of legal action. I mean, we have a moral responsibility to deliver clean air, an ecological responsibility to deliver clean air, and a legal requirement to deliver clean air. So it all comes together. We can't wait until we've made up for the four decades of the city's failure to deliver a meaningful mass transit system. We have to act now. But we are delivering the mass transit system. And let me just point out one other thing as well that's really important, because focusing on the diesel ban, what we've avoided in our clean air zone is avoiding private car drivers as well.
Okay, but it's the beginning of a process, isn't it? Once the system's in, then it won't be very difficult to go to charging cars, will it?
But that's not where we're intending to go. Our principles, and we've taken the hits for standing by our principles of taking care of people in Bristol, have been evidenced. What we know we need to do, and we've put this out, we have to earn the right. We have to provide viable alternatives. We're not going to war with car drivers, and I get the people saying I love cars and so forth. My stance has always been, we are not going to war with car drivers. What we are trying to do is provide viable alternatives.
The only trouble is, of course, a lot of people don't think that the Bristol public transport system is up to the job, Antar. This could be, potentially, it could lose the mayor a lot of votes. Because I understand it's the first city in Europe to... it may even be, I don't know, other parts of the world have ever done it before. It sets a real big precedent, this diesel ban.
Yeah, well, I think it really could be very damaging to the businesses in the city, because the infrastructure in Bristol is obviously inadequate, not just public transport, but also how do you get across Bristol without driving through the city centre? Well, we don't have an efficient ring road system.
The taxi drivers are going to have to pay £9 a day, apparently. Now, they're absolutely up in arms in that. Now, that's public transport. Whatever you say about taxis, they're public transport, and it seems like the public... This seems to me as if it's just a kind of an excuse, Martin, to just to rake a bit more money in.
Well, look,
a bit of a racket.
Well, really. the reality is that you can't really solve problems like this at this level. We've had, 10 years of austerity where the ultimately local authorities in the near future are going to be doing adult social care and nothing else. So in many ways, that's where we're going. If you fulfill your statutory duties, and that's the end of it. And local government, in fact, has got all of these expectations are placed on it. And the reality is that if you've got you're bailing out the banking system, which is underlying everything that's gone wrong in this country over the last 10 years. That's why we've had a deficit, so that the private sector didn't collapse. And that has been forgotten. Of course, when it collapses again, it won't be forgotten.
So you think this is the right thing to do as a reply to the banking
collapse? Let me put this to you. When the congestion charge was introduced in London, lots of people moaned and groaned, but it's now stuck, nobody's going to change it, are they?
But the taxi drivers don't pay it because they're public transport. The buses don't pay it because they're public transport.
Well, I'm willing to sit to listen
but to... But they're going to have to.
I'm willing to listen to arguments about whether this particular scheme that Marvin is suggesting is the correct way to go. But I think ultimately you've got to look at the bigger picture. We need infrastructure investment on a massive scale in this country, and it's got to be in public transport. You should have done it 30 years ago.
You've got a petrol car or diesel car?
I've got a petrol car, Tony.
Oh, well,
you've got a diesel car, though, haven't you?
No, house. Well, anyway, the whole idea of, I mean, we're talking about £50-60 fines for driving through the city centre seems an interesting way to try and do this. And the obvious thing, which most people have been saying, is look, you know, you've got to get the public transport sorted out first. Then you could, you know, do what you want. But if the public transport's not there, this is a very pernicious way to go. So we'll see how this all plays out over the next months and years. But Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees, although he won't come on this programme, and we'll have to have another go in the run-up to, obviously, to the mayoral elections, to try and get him on with the other mayoral candidates. He's been hitting the headlines this week in the national press, not necessarily in a good way either. The Bristol Post apologises for a mugshot picture of mixed-race mayor. That was in the Times. And the Bristol Post has apologised for a front-page story with Marvin Rees on there, saying, and the actual headline is, State of the City Address, I'll pave the way for the future. Next to a very close-up shot of Marvin, and the mayor promises a new Circle Line bus route which will allow city centre to be pedestrianised, and that's on pages 4 and 5 in the Bristol Post. But apparently this picture looks like a prison mugshot of the mayor, and people are complaining, at least some people in the city, the Racial Equality Department, are saying that it's actually a racist picture because it tries to portray him as a criminal. So I think we'll start with you, Anne. You've seen the picture. I'll put a copy of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I wondered, when you look at that, does that make you think that this is a criminal mugshot taken by the police or something?
Well, it is quite an aggressive headline saying, I'll pave the way for the future. But I wouldn't exactly say that looks like a criminal mugshot to me.
Martin, we had very similar sorts of things with George Ferguson before. Mm. Very close-up shots of him on the front page of the Bristol Post.
Well, I think the way in which narratives are developed in this society are very complex, you know, and people can take offence at all sorts of things. I don't suppose that Marvin has complained. He's got publicity for what he's trying to do, which we've just been discussing.
Marvin, as far as we understand, Marvin is not a criminal in any way.
Well, indeed.
Although his father, Valentine Walker, was a criminal in the city,
Marvin has never hidden that. I mean, I spoke to him years ago about this. I've never made a secret of the fact that my father has got this bad reputation, but it's nothing to do with me. In fact, basically, he's spent most of his life trying to live down who his father is, and he had very little to do with him as a child. He was brought up by his mother. And I think that, you know, I think that it's right for people to be concerned that people get the right sort of presentation and that they're not being, you know, pigeonholed or downgraded. But on the other hand, we've got to get a sense of perspective.
Stick my neck out
it's just a picture.
This is exactly the way that Ferguson was portrayed. Very close-up shots on the front page of the newspaper. Anyway, finally, we've got an amazing new policy from John McDonnell over the last day or so, which is nationalising BT Openreach, Martin.
Yes, well, obviously it's news to me, and of course they haven't actually put the manifesto together. That will come out next week. But I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, if you vote for us, we really are going to do some big stuff. We're not just going to be tinkering.
Were you quite surprised by this, Anne? What do you think of it?
Well, I understand the need for better broadband and for Wi-Fi generally across the UK. We're lagging behind the international standards, and it just helps exacerbate poverty, especially poverty in the countryside where you don't have access to everything you have in the city. I'm not entirely certain that the solution is to nationalise it, though. The cost is eye-watering, and I just worry about the effect of taxation of that level on the country.
I mean, if surely back in the old days, the post office saying we're going to have nationalised an entire all the telephones in, I suppose that was the equivalent back in, say, the 1940s and 1950s. That was a big job too.
I can remember back in the 1980s having to wait 6 months to get a second phone installed into the home, and we don't want to go back to that sort of system. What is needed is better broadband structure across the UK. That is unargued.
So you don't want to nationalise it. What would you do to actually make sure that the broadband does get out there? I mean, you see foreigners coming to this country. I say, I can't believe I can't get broadband in your house. You can't get broadband in your house. Yeah, actually, you're maybe not in the city centre, but quite a lot of the fringes of our cities, you just simply can't get it.
Well, no, I live in Portishead, as you know, and it's absolutely shocking out there. So we do have issues out there ourselves. So you can compel companies to do this, and we just have to compel BT and Openreach to actually deliver what they say they're going to do.
Okay, right. Thanks to our guests, the Brexit Party candidate, ex, not no longer, for North Somerset and Tar, and also retired teacher and South West NUT rep Nina Franklin. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. We take our weekly look around the world.
Radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Boris Johnson's attacked what he's called Labour's crazed communist scheme to offer every household free broadband. Jeremy Corbyn's party says it'll nationalise part of BT if it wins the general election next month. But the Prime Minister says the Conservatives have a massive infrastructure programme, which will be helped by getting Brexit done.
It will be something that clears our arteries, it will unblock our system, it will get us back on our feet and able to take advantage of all the things that we want to get from Brexit.
Meanwhile, the Lib Dems are promising to spend £100 billion on tackling climate change. A former US advisor to Donald Trump has been convicted of lying and witness tampering. Roger Stone faces up to 20 years in prison following an investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Meanwhile, the former US ambassador to Ukraine says she felt very intimidated by Donald Trump tweeting an attack as she testified at his impeachment inquiry. Marie Yovanovitch was ousted from her post after coming under fire from the president's personal lawyer. Mr. Trump tweeted that everywhere she went as a diplomat turned bad. This was her response to the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee.
I actually think that where I've served over the years, I and others have made things better, you know, for the U.S. as well as for the countries that I've served in.
A second man's been arrested after a woman's body was found dumped in a wheelie bin in East Sussex. Nicholas Stevenson's body was found by a dog walker in Lewes on Wednesday. Former St Mirren and Sunderland boss Jack Ross has been appointed as the new manager of Hibs. He's agreed to a 3.5-year contract. And Taylor Swift's former record label denies the singer's being blocked from performing her own songs. Big Machine, who owns much of the star's back catalogue, says the criticism is false information. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.